Timothy. All right, tonight we're down in 1 Timothy chapter 1 and beginning in verse 7. Or to charge certain men not to teach a different doctrine. So he's going to be having to fight false doctrine. Now, as he tells him this, he said, "Now I want you to charge certain men that they're not to teach a different doctrine, and then I want you to teach them that they are not to give heed to fables or genealogies. That is, stay away from them, shun away from them, run, don't get involved in them, because all of these things." Just go ahead and minister. The word minister means work. It works up questionings. And there's always questionings that are involved. When you thinking about questionings, unless you ask questions, you never really learn anything. What does a child do during its most productive years of gleaning knowledge? When it gets to the two-year-old on up to whenever it quits learning, three or whatever it is, what does it do in those years? What's the one thing that it does? About the only thing that it says is just why. You answer that and they say why, and then why. And they're absorbing everything. So a person that doesn't ask questions is a person that really doesn't learn very much. So asking question is good, but yet questionings are bad. It's a very bad, terrible thing in the church to have questionings. Now, it's good to have, when you thinking about questionings, unless you ask questions, you never really, in the Bible, does God ever try to discourage even, let alone condemn? He doesn't even discourage somebody asking questions. In fact, does he encourage it? Who were more noble than somebody? The Bereans were more noble than those at Thessalonica because they knew everything. No, it's because they searched the Scriptures. What were they doing when they searched the Scriptures? What does that tell you? They didn't know something, right? They heard Paul preach. What was in their mind? Is that really right? Is that true? Did Isaiah say that? I wonder what he meant by that. And because they had questions, they went to the Scriptures and they found the answers. And so having an inquisitive mind is a good thing. That's what causes you to learn. So what does it mean here that these fables and genealogies, they work or minister questionings? What it's talking about is that is the end result. Now, let me put it like this to do it. We didn't talk about this last week, so let me put it like this. Suppose now that we have questions. What is the end result of sincere questions? Let's take the Bereans and Thessalonians. Take the Bereans. They obviously had questions. What is the end result out here of people that have an inquisitive mind and do ask questions? All right, the end of it is you're going to find the answer, right? If you do that. See, you're going to go out there and find the answer. So they went to the right place. They went to the Bible. And the end of that out here is then that they found the answer, and that answer was Jesus Christ. Now then, down here, though, we're going to take this, and we're going to have questions here, questionings in here. Now, they minister questionings. You say, well, there's not too much about that. I mean, not too much difference in there. And there's not. Now, here's where my chart goes bad. So here's what I want you to see. I have to rub this chart out if I'm going to mine and do ask questions. All right? The clear over here. Now then, here's where we put the questioning. What do we put over here? Right, okay, these myths are over here. Myths and genealogies. Shun away from them. Because as long as you're involved in studying these things, I don't care how you study it. I don't care what your inquisitive mind is, how sincere you are. It doesn't make me any difference. Where you go to the Bible, study history, study Plato. I don't care what you get. The end result of these things is what? Question. Now, there is a difference, you see, in asking questions up here when you're actually studying the Bible and you're studying the gospel and you're going to the right source. When you question, ask questions in this, you end up with answers. But down here, when you get off into these things, the end result is this down here. Now let's take a church, two churches. One of them is a church that has the answers to the problems. They have their answers, they have their questions answered. They're sincere, they go to God, they want to know what God says, they ask questions, they turn there, and they find it, and they have the answers. So there's a church that has answers. And here's a church that has questionings. Now then, describe a church that has questionings. Tell me about a questioning church. What is its characteristics? Is it solid and stable and peaceful and harmonious? No. The only thing that they have is everybody is differing from everybody else, and everybody is doubting this, and everybody's doubting that, and they're searching around, and they can't find any answers. Why can't they find any answers? The answers aren't there. They're looking at the wrong place. The answers aren't there. When you get back in here into these things have no basis, and so whatever you deal with, there's no answering out there. Now, we could go ahead and parallel this, really, with false doctrine. That actually, when you get into false doctrine, let's take Calvinism, for example, in here. I'll just put down number 3. Now, these up here is the one the Bible uses. This down here will be mine. Now, then, right in here. I am a very studious individual, and I want to know everything about everything, and so I'm going to become an expert on Calvinism. And so I'm going to really study Calvinism and go into depths on Calvinism. What will be the end result of this thing? Okay, let me ask you, what good will be produced? No good. I just know everything about Calvinism. That's really what I'll know, everything about it. You say everything, and then you start asking me some questions. And, I never thought of that, in here. I can't answer that. You're going to start asking questions I can't answer. Now you say, who started this? I can answer that, I can tell you about how it started by a certain old church father, and Calvin then revived it down in the 15th century and so forth, and brought it back up again. Well, what was in Calvin's mind when he did that? I don't really know. When you get back to the very father back in here, and when you get out here, there's no good that will be produced. The only thing that we can do is just get out here and raise a whole lot more questions and get to arguing about the thing. And even if you could find the right answer, what have you got? Absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. Now, I don't care what you do over in here, any kind of a false doctrine, anything that falls under this category, of which really that would fall under the thing, any false doctrine, and you're going to become an expert in that, you're going to end up out there with just a great big zero. That's all it is. One time I took a course in college on the thinking of modern theologians. So they study this, and so you study all these guys that come up with this doctrine of existentialism and all these various doctrines, and we would write papers on the thing, and I've got them in there in my library now, and here's some big papers on, this guy's philosophy and that guy's philosophy. And when you get through, what do you have? Now, I'll tell you what you have. You have paper. That's what you have. But it's worthless because it's written on. See? And so you can't reuse it again. And you could go in, read every paper I wrote in that class, and I will guarantee you, you would not glean one iota of good out of it. There's not one thing out of it. I had to take the dumb course in order to get through school. They made you take it. But when you get through, there's nothing out there. And I remember the feeling that you'd study this guy, and you'd read his books, and you'd get through, and my, oh my, see, of what you've got. Now, this is not something that's way out in left field. Let me just give you an illustration. that in today's culture, religious culture, in the denominationalism I'm talking about, you see, in the religious activities here in America, I don't know how you would break up what you would call your liberal churches and your conservative churches. Anybody know how you'd break them up? The Baptists, they're both liberal and conservative. So you have some that are conservative. Jimmy Carter now is condemning the conservatives. And he's afraid the conservatives are going to take over the Southern Baptist Association. So now then he's going to the liberals. And so you can't even put all the Baptists in the conservative camp. Really, when you break it down, I suppose it'd be about 90-95% liberal and 5-10% conservatives is what it would be. Now, your conservatives, 99% of your conservatives teach Calvinism. If you're going to be studying that, that's what you'd be studying. Then 95-99% of your liberals teach existentialism. Now, that is a big word. And really, if you want to be smart, you ought to know about existentialism, shouldn't you? Because all of the great theologians of our generation and the past generation believe in existentialism. And there's no way you can talk with them. And I remember asking a teacher, and that's been 4 or 5 years ago too, way back there, 20, 30 years ago, I remember asking a teacher, why are we studying this junk? I mean, I really didn't understand why we were studying it. And he said, well, in case you ever talk to one of them, you can understand his language, because you can't understand otherwise. Well, that's good, because I sure want to understand them. But how many of them do I find to talk to out here? You don't find too many of them to talk to out there. And so, and even if you understood their language, it's silly to do it. Now, one time it's helped me tremendously. I maybe ought to take time to tell you the story, but one time in 30 years, why I've got some good out of that one course that I took. But anyway, existentialism is this. That is that these great philosophers and religious teaching. Now remember this. This is what the Methodists teach. This is what the Lutherans teach. This is what the Episcopalians and Unitarians and all of them. See, they're deeply embedded in all this. The Congregationalists, the United Church of Christ, and on down the line, they all are embedded in this thing. And that is that they look at it and they reject the Bible as the inspired Word of God. That, first of all, is a bunch of nonsense. It is not the literally inspired Word of God. So what are we going to do with it? We have to do something with it. Now, do Methodist preachers today get up and say, we reject the Bible? Do they do that? Or do they say, we believe the Bible? Oh yes, we believe the Bible. Do you know that Presbyterian Church had almost had a split? And finally, about 10 years ago, they finally got it put in their constitution that you no longer had to believe in the inspiration of the Scriptures in order to be a Presbyterian minister. Up to that time, it was in there. You had to believe in the inspiration of the Scriptures. And that gave a lot of those fellows problems, because they had taken their oath, you see, back 20 years ago when they were young men. They believed it. And then they studied it, and they no longer believe it. And now then, according to the Constitution of the Presbyterian Church, they can't serve as a minister. But they don't know how to do anything else, so what do you do? See? And so there was a big fight. Finally, they got it through. So Presbyterians now, Presbyterian preachers, have it in there. They no longer have to believe in the inspiration of the Scriptures. So we do away with that. So then we say, okay, now what are we going to do? These things are not what it says. So they said, they came up with this idea. Okay, what the Bible is like an onion. You read the Bible, and then you start peeling away the stuff that doesn't apply to us. And when you peel an onion, you know, you take the outer layer and you throw it away, and what do you have? Another layer. So you look it over and you say, is this where I want to eat? No, let's peel off this layer. So you keep peeling it off. And you keep peeling it off. And you keep peeling. And finally, what do you get down to with an onion? To the very center. Just a little hard knot. And you say, is that what an onion is all about? Is that what you buy onions for? You women bring onions home, peel them all off to get down to that little hard knot in there? No. Well, you know that's not it, so you throw it away. What have you got? You peeled an onion. What have you got? Nothing. Now, I'm not making this up. These are the books I read. See, these are the papers I wrote. This is the way they described it. And so, you take the Bible, and you start peeling it away. You throw baptism. That's silly, you know, to do that. And you throw this away, and this, and this, and this. Then you get down. What are we going to keep? Are we going to keep? And you throw this away, and you throw this away. And finally, they throw the whole thing away. So then they say, okay, what is there? What is it? What? In other words, they're frustrated. Now, you have to feel sorry for these guys because they are trying to find the meaning of life. Now, these are your big theologians. These are the guys that write in the big magazines. These are your Norman Vincent Peales. See? What is life all about? And they're striving to get something. I want something I can stand on. I want something I can sink my teeth in. I want something I can feel good about. What can I feel good about? And what is there? And finally, they get to thinking, what can you know for sure? And so they start peeling everything away. And they look out, technology. Can you put your faith in technology? No. Politics. Put it in politics? No. Science? No. Business? No, there's some corruption in there. What can you put it in? Real estate? Oh, there's some bad deals in real estate. So you get down, and do you know that they've all come to one conclusion? There's one thing you can just write down, and it's for sure. Now, an atheist won't agree with this, but these deeply religious people, this is the one thing. The one thing. You know what it is? Now, you're going to think I'm making this up. I'm talking about myths we're living in today. See, you hear about evolution all the time. I'm talking about existentialism. You know what the one thing is that you can just sink your teeth in and you know for sure? We're here. See, that's it. You can't even trust yourself if you say yourself. See? Because you do bad things. But the one thing is, I am. Now, I don't know whether you are or not. I mean, that's a big deal with them. I think I see you. See? I'm sure. I reach over and I touch his head. And that felt like he was there. But I'm not sure, really, because that just may be my nerves tingling or something like this. But the one thing is, I am. I exist. That's it. Now, an atheist, they'll even argue you don't even know whether you exist or not. But these deeply religious men, that's the difference between them and an atheist. They say, I exist. And so then they get the doctrine, existentialism. So the whole thing's built on that. So now that's the only thing that you really have to believe. Now then, let's start building our life. Now what is it I know? I know that everything I've ever done has faltered. You know, I go in business and it fails. And I buy this and it wears out. And I move in a house and the roof leaks. And I get a friend and they do something and they fail me. And I get married and my wife died. And I haven't had anything. That nothing in this world that I can really say, here it is, I've got it, except I am. So I start out. Now, I chunk it all away. Now I'm going to be born again. Now I'm going to be born again. Now what's the new definition for born again? It's finding what I want to do with my life. That's what it is. Yeah, maybe I have been a plumber or a doctor. And I say, I've hated medicine. I went into medicine to please my daddy. I've always wanted to be a plumber. What is my new birth? I throw it away and go become a plumber and I'm born again. See? That is it. Now, to be born again then, you have to have a resurrection. And that really is what a resurrection is. Is when I throw my medical practice away and I rise to the new heights of becoming a plumber. And that's the resurrection. Now, Jesus didn't really raise from the grave. See? He didn't really raise. All of that is a myth. It's a story. And it's a story like Little Red Riding Hood. Little Red Riding Hood teaches little girls they shouldn't stop and talk to bad men. See? But it's just a story. Now, there's no Big Bad Wolf, there's no Little Red Riding Hood, and there's no Grandma. It's a story, but it teaches a lesson. Now, Jesus Christ, he was merely a man. He was not the Son of God. He didn't raise from the dead. He didn't ascend into heaven. It's a story, but it teaches something. What does it teach you? It teaches every man that they need to do what Jesus did. They need to kill their old self. In my case, quit being a medical doctor. And bury it. Get rid of it. And then raise again. See, be resurrected as a plumber. Go down, join the plumber's union, and now then, I've had resurrection. That's all that his resurrection really taught. Now, if you ask them, do you believe in the resurrection of Christ, what will they say? Yeah. And they do. They believe the same way I believe in Little Red Riding Hood. See? That's all that they believe. Now, that's around you all the time. See? That is around you all the time. We're living in that particular era. So don't think as you read these words, that only applied back there. Now let me tell you the story real quickly. This happened. Steve Voss was with me. There was a Presbyterian a few years ago that heard us on the radio, and the Congregational Church was trying to swallow up the Presbyterian Church, and they were both going to join the United Church of Christ. There's going to be a big amalgamation. And the these Presbyterians were conservatives, and they still believed in the Bible, even though their preacher didn't. And they didn't want to do that. So they flew out the man who had been the previous president of the United Church of Christ, and he was the vice president now, down here to Bellevue. He was going to answer all questions. And so they wanted me to come down then. They called me because it was on the radio and said, would you come down and help us? We would like for you to expose these men. You say they believe this. And I told them, now then, would you come down and show it? And I said, well, yeah, okay, I will. I thought maybe I could convert the Presbyterians. That's what I was wanting to do. So one Sunday afternoon then, it came, Steve Voss and I go down. This guy gets up and he begins to tell about all of this. And he's up there and he tells about all the lovely stuff, you know, that they're going to do and wah, wah, wah. And so we were sitting around there, and he said, now I'm going to give you a speech, and then I'll just take any questions you want to ask. Now I want you to know this is an open meeting, and we're here to answer questions. That's what I came out for. We'll answer anything that you want. You know, he's trying to show we're not hiding anything. So he gives his little speech, and he says, now are there any questions? So I raised my hand. I wanted to ask mine and then get out. And yes, sir. Well, very friendly. And so I asked him, I said, sir, do you believe in the inspiration of the Bible, the verbal inspiration of the Bible? Oh, yes. Oh, yes. The Bible is the most wonderful book, certainly. Oh, my, that the whole religion is based upon the Bible. I said, well, let me finish my question. I said, for instance, do you believe that Adam and Eve was a literal man and a woman? Or do you believe that they were just a myth, like Little Red Riding Hood? Oh, I believe in Adam and Eve, certainly. Oh, my. That is one of my favorite stories, the story of the Garden of Eden and Adam and Eve. I think about that a lot. It's one of my favorite stories. And he started telling about that. So I believe it. I want to ask you, you didn't answer my question. I know you believe in it, but do you believe there was a literal man named Adam and a literal woman named Eve? Do you believe that? Oh, I believe in Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve teaches us so many things and blah, 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 blah. Because I said, you didn't answer my question. Now, I want to know, I know you believe in Adam and Eve, just like I believe in Little Red Riding Hood and the Big Bad Wolf. I believe in both of them. But I do not believe there was a Little Red Riding Hood and a Big Bad Wolf. I think it was a story. Now, I want to know, do you believe there was an actual man, a real man in a human body named Adam, and a real woman named Eve in a real garden named Eden? And he saw that I was pinning him down, see, like this. And finally then, he says, well, he said, if you mean literally, he said, I don't know if it was a literal thing. He said, it doesn't have to be literal. He said, the story is put in there to teach us a nice story. He said, that's the whole point. You don't have to get down to whether it was a literal thing or whether it was a story. And then he started in and he says, the Bible, he said, the Bible is just a book of stories that those men wrote. And said they did the best they could. They didn't make any mistakes intentionally. Oh, boy, that was great, you know, to say that he believed that. He believes it's full of mistakes, you see, but they didn't do it intentionally. He said, hey, Paul. He said, Paul wrote his life story. So he just wrote about his travels. So he just wrote down, you know, just his diary, telling about where he traveled and where he went and the things he did. And that's what the Bible is composed of, is stories. He said, you know, he said, I think, said, that we ought to be doing that today. Said, I think, said, those of us who are traveling preachers, we ought to be writing down. I don't have to get down to whether it was a literal thing or whether it was a story. And then he started in. And when he said that, I said, that is blasphemy. And then the crowd just came unglued. They said that. People started yelling. And I'll never forget, there was a guy right in front of me that was sitting there. John Glenn had just orbited the Earth. That tells you it's been quite a while ago. And he had orbited the Earth not too long, you know, a few years before that. And this guy was sitting there, and he turned around like this and started yelling, "Are you trying to tell me John Glenn wasn't inspired when he orbited the Earth?" You see? You saying he wasn't inspired? You know? Well, I knew what he meant by inspired. What did he mean by inspired? Excited. That's right. Well, you bet, man. His stomach was pumping, you know, and his blood pressure was up. And I said, well, I think he had a great experience, but he wasn't inspired like I'm talking about, you see. God hadn't inspired him. Oh, he said, I disagree with that. And he said, I think you're a blasphemer. And he, you know, he's gone. And then other people started arguing. All over this, people started arguing. And it was a mess. And this guy says, let me tell you something. Said, now, tell you what we're going to do. He said, now, we're going to have a prayer, and we're going to be dismissed. He said, let's pray. Everybody pray. So we had a prayer, and he said, now we'll be dismissed, and we'll have, there's cookie and coffee in there. And Steve and I get up and walk out, and everybody just looked at us like we were from Mars, you see, somewhere like that. And those people didn't even get up and walk out with me. And so we walked out, we got out the door, and they sneaked out another way and ran back to the door and said, thanks, we really appreciate you coming. And they sneaked back in again and went on. I've never seen them since that day, so I don't know what happened. But anyway, it didn't come to any good. But I say it did do me some good in sense that you have to know how to talk to those people. Now, that's a long story, but you're living among them, see, all of these myths and everything. And you get involved in all that kind of philosophy and that kind of nonsense, and all it does is end up out here with this. Now, he starts out and he says, shows that a church can get in that situation. What church was in that situation? The church at Ephesus was in that situation. Who had preached at Ephesus for 2 years and 3 months? And so we walked out, we got out the door, and they sneaked out another way and ran back to the door and said, thanks, we really appreciate you coming. And even among them, Paul said, some of you are going to arise and start teaching false doctrine. So this thing, you see, can happen. It did happen in New Testament times, and it can happen in our time. So what he's doing here is writing to Timothy, telling him to do the work of an evangelist, and what he says is, you charge other men not to preach a different doctrine, and then what are you to do with this kind of junk? Stay away from it. Just stay away from it. Put your attention to that which is productive, because this over here is not productive. Now, he says, now the end of the charge is love out of a pure heart. This is where we got through then last week. That is that after we get through with this whole thing in here, the end result is I want you to be a certain kind of an individual. And so I want you to have, he said, love out of a pure heart and good conscience and faith unfeigned. Now, you remember we talked about those things. See, that's the example that you're supposed to have. All right. When he says that now, from this end of the charge, and I guess to really see the next thing, we need to put it down up here. It said, now the end of the charge is, number one, we're to have love. Number two, you're to have a pure heart. Number three, you're to have a good conscience. What, by the way, is the definition of a good conscience? The end of the charge is love out of a pure heart. This is where we got through then last week. That is that after we get through with this situation, that you're doing what you believe to be right. That's right. You're the kind of individual that you do what you believe to be right. And then, number four, that you're to have a certain kind of a faith. And what kind of a faith is it? Faith unfeigned. And what does unfeigned mean? Not faked. In other words, it is a true, unhypocritical faith. Now that, he says, is the kind of an individual that I want you to be, and you cannot be that kind of individual when you're dealing with this kind of stuff that is right here. So stay away from it. Don't preach anything other than the Bible and stay away from that. Now, I think most of us know love. Most of us know pure heart, but sometimes we don't really latch on to that next thing. All right, this things over here, see, is what it's talking about. These things that I've just got through talking about right in here now, from these things, some, having swerved, have turned aside unto vain talking. Now, there's some people that have swerved out of the way, and they're not living this kind of a life. See, they've swerved, and they're missing it, and what are they doing? Well, they've turned aside from that kind of living over there, and now then, they're involved in vain talking. Now, this vain talking, obviously, some having swerved aside, let me ask you this question. From what we've said tonight, how would you swerve aside from this? If you go this route right here, right there, the end of it is that. You stay with the gospel, stay with the Bible, study the Bible, the end of it is this. How do you swerve and miss it? It's by that over there, isn't it? See, your miss and your genealogies. All right, now those people that do this then, that it ends up in questions, they swerve, and it never leads you to this kind of pure life that is over here, but it does lead you to something else. What is the end result? This is what it is if you go to the gospel. Now then, tell me the end result if you go this route and you swerve around. What is it? All right, vain talking. Now, do these fellows do any talking? They do a lot of talking, don't they? What's it worth? Nothing. See, it's totally vain. Now, take all that story that I told you about what these great philosophers teach. What was it worth to you? I mean, what are you going to use? How much of that are you going to use to put in practice tomorrow? Not one thing. It's just entertaining. That's all. See? Just entertaining. And the only possible good you could get from that long story, and I told it for this one possible thing, is that any time that you ever run across one of these fellows, that you'll understand what they're talking about, and you can talk their language, and you pin them down. See? Pin them down, make them give you an answer in there. And because people, when they get involved in this, they swerve around and they come to this this kind of vain talking. Don't believe that they're not people like that. Just they're all over the place. The vast majority of the religious people are out there. Don't get in thinking all these nice religious people. They're not that way. See, they're not that way. Another example comes to my mind. I'll tell you this quickly. One time I was driving through Kentucky, I saw a sign down there that the city where the first organ was introduced into the Church of Our Lord. And so I drive down, I'm trying to find this church building. And finally, my wife said, why don't you go to the Christian church? Maybe that's what it is. So I go up there and I walk in, the preacher's there. And I tell him, I say, I'm looking for the building where they introduced the organ for the first time. He said, you found it, this is it. And I said, well, fine. I said, I wanted to come and see what it looks like. And it doesn't look like it does in history books. And he said, well, we build a new front on out here and so forth. And so I looked down, and he had the notes of back in the 1870s. You know, and he was sitting there, and he was really proud. He said, yeah, this is a great historical church. And so-and-so preached here, and some of the old pioneer preachers, you know, preached here, and all of this. And so I thought, well, I'll ask him really how far it's gone. Now, you see, when they started out. So I asked him, I said, let me ask you, said, do you call yourself a conservative people now, or are you a liberal? He said, oh, he said, we're very socially minded. He said, our activities are socially orientated. And I said, well, what do you teach about baptism? Do you teach baptism is essential for salvation? He said, we're composed of all kinds. He said, we've got people here that actually believe that you have to be baptized. He said, there are some here that believe that. And he said, then of course, he said, there's a lot that do not believe it. He said, but that's not an important thing with us. And I said, well, do you believe that the Bible is inspired? Well, he said, we have some people here that actually believe it is inspired. He said, there are some here that believe it's inspired, and there are others that don't. Then he explained, you know, and it's rather silly to believe it, but we don't run the people off. I mean, we have people here who believe it, and we let them stay. And so I said, well, do you believe in the resurrection of Christ? I asked him four, five, six questions, but finally I got down. Do you believe that Jesus actually raised from the dead? Well, he said, we have some people here that believe that. And he said, then we have people who don't. And he said, it's interesting you'd ask that. He said, I was rather shocked the other day. He said, we were in a meeting, said, with my elders. And one of my elders that said, the one that I thought would really believe in the resurrection, said, he said in the elders meeting, he said, I never have believed in that stuff. He said, I never have believed in that story. And he said, I was rather shocked. He said, I kind of had him pinpointed as one of them who did. He said, we have people here who believe in the resurrection, and then it doesn't. Said, you see, said, you don't understand. Said, that kind of stuff, said, that makes no difference in the resurrection of Christ. I asked him four, five, six questions, but finally I got down. Do you believe that Jesus? He said, we try to get out and do what Christ wants us to do. And we believe in the social aspect. Said, that's the only thing, said, we're involved in. And I said, well, you've answered my question. I appreciate it. And I went on my way. Now, that is the same place of where gospel preachers, Alexander Campbell, J.W. McGarvey, Moses E. Lard, all of those men stood and preached, and the very hotbed of the Restoration Movement, of where it was striving back in there and growing. What would they say today if they came back and went back and asked what was going on back then? See? So don't think that difference to us. Said, we don't care about that. Said, you see, said, we do social with problems that can happen to us at any given time. Don't take false religions lightly. Those men are vain talkers. That's all it is to it. That's what the Bible says. Now, they're vain talkers desiring to be teachers of the law. Literally, law teachers. The same word as doctors of the law in the gospel. They want to be doctors of the law. They want to be vain teachers. You ever get the idea that some people want to teach or preach because of the status that it might give them? Do you ever get the idea that some people feel that in order to really teach or preach, they have to use big words and they have to become highly educated so that they can leave an impression upon people, see, in that realm? I get that feeling a lot of times. And that's what he's saying here. These people, they desire that position. They want to be law teachers, though they understand neither what they say nor whereof they confidently affirm. Now, these fellows that are talking this way, they confidently affirm it. Man, they say this is the way it is. They don't understand what they say, and they don't understand what they confidently affirm. Now, I suppose if you walked up to any one of them and said, do you know what you just said? He'd say yes. And I'm sure he could tell you what he said. But he doesn't know what he said. I'm with Paul. Paul said that they don't know what they say. And yet I know. You could ask them, what did you say? And they could repeat it. So what did Paul mean? He didn't mean that they don't understand the words they say. It means they do not understand the consequences of what they say. They do not understand the end result of what they say. They pick up a certain doctrine and they teach it, and they think this is great. But if they had the wisdom to be able to look down and see the end result of this false teaching, that it teaches a certain thing, then they wouldn't say that. As I was telling one person today who does not believe in Calvinism, but they said, I believe that really Christianity is an exchanged life rather than a changed life. In other words, rather than a Christian changing their life, that actually Christ took our old life out and put His life in, and so it's Christ, you see, like this. I tell them, well, now you don't understand what you say. Oh, I don't? Why? Well, you're preaching Calvinism. Is what you're teaching. Well, I don't believe Calvinism. No, I know you don't. But if if I argued with you, I could force you back into the wall, because I could force you and show you, if Christ said, if Christ is in me, if it's not Lowell anymore, Lowell's gone, and it's Christ, how much wrong is Christ going to do while He's living in my body? Is he going to do anything wrong? Well, certainly he's not going to do anything wrong. So then, if I go out and do something wrong, have I sinned? No. Either Christ did it wrong, or, you know what the explanation of Calvinists are? No, he didn't do it. It's just your sinful body. Your body's guilty, but your spirit's not. And so, whatever you do, murder, commit adultery, whatever you do, you're not guilty. It's just your body that is guilty. And so you're forced back in to something. So what I'm saying is, a lot of times when we make statements, when we teach something, we don't know what we're saying. And somebody that makes that statement does not know what they're saying. They do not know that they're actually teaching Calvinism. So that's what it's saying here, that these people have not thought through what they're actually teaching. Now then, in verse 8, by the way, before we go to verse 8, what did these fellows want to teach? Today we might have somebody that wants to teach on some idea, let's say existentialism, since I brought it up before. What was their problem back there? What did those guys want to be teachers of back in that day? The law. They wanted to be teachers of the law. They wanted to be the doctors of the law, so they would be highly respected. All right, here's what he says. He says in verse 8, "But we know that the law is good if a man use it lawfully." Now, Paul said, I'm not condemning the law. I'm not saying that the law is not good. The law is good if a man use it lawfully. The thing that was wrong with these fellows is, as they were teaching the law, they were not teaching it as it was supposed to be taught. That's what lawfully means. Lawfully means in the spirit of the law, or in the way that the law is to be used. Now, the Old Testament law was given for a specific purpose, wasn't it? And it was given for a specific time. And in order to be a doctor of the law or a teacher of the law, you have to teach the law in exactly the way the law was given. See, you have to teach the very purpose of the law. These people didn't. They just wanted to be law teachers. And so they started out to teach the law, but they didn't teach it lawfully. That is, they didn't teach it in the way God intended for it to be used. They were misusing. They were thinking that it was an eternal law, that it was never to be taken out of the way. It was a spatial law given to the Jews, excelling and so forth, never to be changed in any way. So Paul then is denying that. So he says, now the law is good. You know another passage where Paul says the law is good and holy and righteous? All right, in Romans, the 7th chapter, down around verse 12. He never condemns the law. He shows it's good. But he says this now. He said, knowing this, that law is not made for a righteous man, but for the lawless and unruly, for the ungodly and sinners, for the unholy and profane, for murderers of fathers and murderers of mothers, and for manslayers, for fornicators, for abusers of themselves with men, for men-stealers, for liars, for false swearers, and if there be any other thing contrary to the sound doctrine, according to the gospel of the glory of the blessed God, which was committed to my trust. All right, now Paul says that the law of Moses, is what he's talking about, but this would be true of any law, but he's specifically talking about that. He says, the law is not made for a righteous man. All right, now first of all, we have to understand this. These people were actually thinking and teaching that the law was made for a righteous man. Now you say, oh, I can't believe anybody would do that. See? All right, let's put it in proper perspective. Who would want to be a law teacher? Would it be a Jew or a Gentile? It's going to be a Jew, isn't it? What did the Jews think of themselves because they were Jews? I mean, if you have a blood test, you find out Abraham's blood goes through there, what do you know about me? I'm a chosen one of God, see. I am a righteous man. And so, just on the nationality or the basis of race, then they were exalting themselves. That's the reason John the Baptist had to tell him one time. He said, why, if being a son of Abraham is anything, God could make a son of Abraham out of these rocks, see, down there. That's all that amounts to. But they exalted themselves because they were Jews. And so, now the law was given to whom? Us Jews. What kind of people are we? Great.
And it's a good law given to us great Jews. Now, whoa. What does the Bible say the law? You find out Abraham's blood goes through there. What do you know about me? I'm always given because of transgression, because of sin. But no, they didn't see that. See, God says it was given because of sin, and it's only to last for a certain period of time to hold you sinners under control until Christ can come. They didn't see it. No, the law is given to us spatially loved people, and it is a great law, and we're going to take this great law and apply it to you Gentiles and to other people, and when Christ comes, takes the law out of the way, are we going to give it up? No, we're going to keep it. See? Well, they're misusing the law. Now then Paul says, the law is not given to righteous people. The very fact that God was given for, it was given to the Jews, but in Galatians 3, what does it say it was given for? Given to righteous people. This week or last week, finally they got a law through Congress for a death sentence for certain kind of dope peddlers and people that do this and kill people and so forth. They finally got that law through. Now let me ask you this. Was Congress working so hard and diligent, and did they put that law in for those of us in this room? Now I know we're under that law. See, I know that we have to obey that law. Is that what they did that for? Is that why they did it? No. When would there ever be a law against using crack if we were the only people in existence, those of us in this room? Never be a law. See, there would be no need. And so law does not come in unless there's a need for law. And what law always comes in for is to control people who are doing something that's wrong. And so he said, now that's the first thing that you need to understand. And these people do not even understand that particular principle. So it's not made for a righteous man. Suppose that all people had been righteous. Never anybody ever did anything wrong. What kind of laws would we have? There wouldn't be a law on the books. There wouldn't be a single law. And you'd say, well, there'd be some tax laws. No, not if we all did what's right. See, now I know why there'd be tax laws, and that's because that you people are so depraved you can't understand it, see? And the reason I know you're depraved is because I am. What would we do if there wasn't a tax law that said you have to pay taxes? Brian, what would you do? You wouldn't pay any taxes. Is that right? Is it right for a man to say just what Brian said? Is it right for a man to live in a country and not pay his way? So why do we have to have tax laws? For scoundrels like Brian. That's the reason we have to have them, see? Yeah, because there are going to be guys like Brian who wouldn't pay it. Now, if everybody at the end of the year said, how much money do we need? The roads are bad. Well, let's divvy it up. Everybody pay their part. What else do we need? Everybody just pay their part. Would we have any tax laws? No. You'd say, but the politicians then would just keep going higher, spending more. No, wait a minute. If they did that, they're doing wrong, right? Then we'd have to have a tax law. But the politicians would never demand more money than what they should. We always pay the amount we should. What kind of tax laws would there be? See, there wouldn't even be a tax law. And so what he's saying is, that's the first thing that we need to understand. So laws are made for ungodly people. Then he starts out and he says, for the lawless and unruly. Now, in your outline that I've given you here, we can kind of break this down, we can see it. Lawless is just talking about transgressors of the law, people that have no regard for that which is right. Unruly is a different kind of a lawless person, and they're the ones that like to resist authority. Now, there are some people that are lawless, but they do not like to resist authority. There are some people that submit to authority, but they don't like authority. Have you ever seen anybody just flat doesn't like authority? They just don't like it, you know. And have you ever seen a wife? Maybe you guys in here have a bunch of them. Have you ever seen a wife that said, I wouldn't mind doing it if you didn't tell me to do it? Has that ever heard it? I've heard that, you see. I've heard that in marriage counseling, you know. She looks all right.
I don't mind ironing his shirt if he didn't tell me to iron his shirt. Well, maybe he is too hard, but what is it telling about it? She doesn't like authority. She wants to do it without being told. What about the driving speed? I wouldn't mind driving 55 miles an hour, but I don't like to be told how fast I can drive. There are people like that. That's what we're talking about, the unruly. Now, when you get somebody that just doesn't like authority, what does he do when you have some authority? Always going to overstep the bounds. So they're the unruly people there. Then there is the ungodly. Now that's the one that has no respect or fear or reverence of God. They do not have the proper attitude toward God. It's a disposition in that way. The next is sinner. Now I've got down here, while the ungodly refers to the attitude, sinner refers to the action. Sinner is breaking the law of God. Ungodly is having a wrong attitude toward God to start with. You see, I might be an ungodly man and not break God's laws. Now, I could be an ungodly person in this way and never break His laws. I read it. I say, okay, now what does God say I can do? Okay, God, oh man, I hate that. I don't know why God wants that. I mean, the very idea. Well, if God said He wants it, I'll do it. I'll show it. I'll do it. Now, I don't break the law. I do exactly what God said. I'm not a sinner. But what am I? I'm an ungodly man. Because I have the wrong attitude toward God. Instead of having awe and respect for God and putting Him in that position where He should be in, I have the wrong attitude. So that is the ungodly thing. Now, unholy is impious, as he's got down here. I think that there's a statement in here that I was wanting to get at right here. Yeah, here it is. This kind of interesting that Plato tells about Socrates. Now, those guys didn't know anything, but the only reason I'm reading them is they did know Greek, didn't they? I mean, they did speak Greek, see? And so, as they spoke Greek, then they wrote down some meanings of words. And so, it's like Webster. I say, Webster said. By the way, what kind of man was Webster? Was he a good moral man, or was he a scoundrel? Did Webster lie? When you call on Webster's authority, are you upholding his life? I don't even know what kind of guy he was. Well, Plato and Socrates, they weren't too good of guys, but here's what it says. It said again, when you're talking about what you do with respect to men is this just that you've got. Now, I want to make sure that I've got... Yeah. Okay, so this just of what he's talking about in here would be the sinner down here, I guess. He wrote down some meanings of words. And so it's like Webster. I say, Webster said. By the way, what kind of man was he? It's not the same word in there for sinner. So he's using a different word. Okay. What he says, let me back up now. This word for just. He said, if you're talking about what you do to men, if I do something wrong toward you, the Greek word for just or justice comes into play. I'm not a just man. But if I do something not befitting to the gods, why did Plato say gods? That's what he believed in. Now, if you do something that's not befitting to the gods, then you are a unholy individual. See, that's the word that he used down there. Irreverent. That you do not have the proper attitude toward God. That's the point that he's making. The next down there is profane. That word literally means that you can trot it underfoot. That's what it's talking about. Now, stuff that you can walk on is a common stuff. What happens if I go down and buy a $12,000 Arabian rug and I don't want to get it dirty? And so I put it in my house. I put a little rope around it or something, you know, in here. You walk in my house. Do you see anything different in there? You see that ribbon around there. And you say, what's that? I say, that's a
$12,000 rug. I don't want your feet on it. It's like that. Well, where can I walk? Anywhere else in the house. I don't care where else you walk. Walk anywhere else in the house. Now, anywhere else in the house is called the profane part of the house. That you can step on. I don't care what else you step on. That's the profane part of the house. Now, this rug is what part of the house? The holy part. What does holy mean? The set apart. I set this apart. You don't prod this underfoot. And so that would illustrate the difference in there where it uses profane. The next is murders of fathers and mothers. That means literally what it says. And we hear of that happening of people that have no regard for their parents, and they do it. The next is manslayers. That's a word that just literally means a killer, somebody that takes another person's life. Fornicators. That word is talking about any and all forms of unlawful sexual relations. Adultery is a specific kind. If that is between married people. But fornication is a general... I don't care what else you step on. That's the profane part of the house. Now, this rug is what part of the house? Itself with men is talking about sodomy. It's talking about homosexuality. Then men stealers are kidnappers. Somebody that steals a person, takes a person for their own personal gain, either to trade them for money or to use them as a slave. The next is a liar. The word liar is one who speaks something false when he knows what the truth really is. If you came in tonight and you said, "Lord, did it rain today?" Or suppose I got a phone call from my mom. She said, "Did it rain today?" No, it didn't rain today. And you come out and you say, "Oh yeah, it was raining during class." "Oh, was it?" "Well, I didn't know that. I told mom it wasn't raining." "Would you call me a liar?" Now, I don't think you'd call me a liar. I certainly didn't tell her the truth. I did it in ignorance. But I'm not a liar. If I know what I'm supposed to be saying and I say something else, that is when I turn into a liar. The other is ignorance. False swearer. That's where you take testimony or swear to something under oath. Now, which is the worst? Perjury, false swearer, or liar? Are they? I think a false swearer is worse. Now, I'm not condoning a liar. I'm not saying liars are good. But a false swearer. Now, the reason for that is that God has always used this himself, and man has always used it. And that is to make a statement under oath. What is the difference in me telling a lie and me telling a lie, God as my witness? What's the difference? That's right. I am showing no respect for God when I do that. And so this other way, I'm merely lying. Perjury is I'm lying plus desecrating God. So it's a double magnified thing that we have there. So those are the things that he boils down that we're opposed to. Yeah. Euthanasia. Or we hear people, you know, young boys today, teenagers, going in with axes. And... Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that, you see, Tim, the way you ask it, I think probably could be give a pretty good answer. If I'm going to commit my parents to a rest home only because of my comfort, then that's selfishness, and that would be wrong. If I commit them there because I think that it would be the best for them, and at the same time it would give me relief, and let's face it, a lot of times that happens, then you have to make that distinction. What am I doing it for? Am I doing it for selfishness? Because it will be a relief. And so as a child, you have a lot of problems in making that decision. But that doesn't alleviate it. One time it would be wrong, another time it would be right. But at any time, when dad and mom become so burdensome, we say, well, it's time to put them to death. You know, then that's what that's talking about. Now, many societies do that. See, many societies do that. The Eskimos, it's a general practice when mom and dad are no longer productive, one day they come in
and they say, "Dad, let's take a sled ride." Now, this is the way it's done. And you put him on a sled. And every man knows he's going to take a sled ride somewhere unless he gets eaten up by a whale. And they take you out, way, way, way out, take you off of the sled. Nothing personal about it. Everybody understands it. It's a way of life. Lay you in the snow and go home. That's the end of your life. That's a way that they get rid then of the people that are unproductive. It's a normal custom. And if you say in England, euthanasia is coming in, and various societies do this. Some people that live in the islands take them out in a boat and dispose of them that way. You would be surprised how many societies practice killing parents. Well, I doubt it, but it would be wise, wouldn't it? Okay, our time is up tonight, so class dismissed. Everybody understands it. It's a way of life. Lay you in the snow and go home. That's the end of your life. That's a way that they get rid then of the people that are unproductive. It's a normal custom. And if you say in England, euthanasia is coming in, and various societies do this. Some people that live in the islands take them out in a boat and dispose of them that way. You would be surprised how many societies practice killing parents. Well, I doubt it, but it would be wise, wouldn't it? Okay, our time is up tonight, so class dismissed.